The concept of soldiering, as I understand it, is one where basically you're given orders to take a position, kill the enemy, or certainly render him or her harmless and immune to your will. How does peacekeeping turn that on its head?
It's an interesting issue because I'm in the camp that says the best peacekeepers are well-trained combat soldiers, but I come at that because politicians tend to want to deploy a military force and assume the best case scenario. They assume that everything will go the way it's been predicted, and if we're going into a safe environment, it'll stay a safe environment. My argument always is, as I think it should be for any commander, is you're going to send my force in there, and I can assure you it's probably going to get worse. It's probably going to be more along the lines of a worst-case scenario, and that's always the big debate. And that causes a pause in deployments, as is happening now into Afghanistan, an absolutely perfect example. But the soldiers themselves, well-disciplined soldiers, will respond and do what they're told to do, and there's a switch on their back, figuratively, where you can go from handing out humanitarian aid and medicine and all of that and helping people get to the hospital or get themselves stitched back together, and they do that very well. And then you flick the switch and you say, okay, it's now a mandate, we got to go and take that hill, and they'll do it if they're well trained. And I was constantly and am asked by American audiences, military audiences, doesn't too much peacekeeping erode what the Americans call the warrior ethic? And I, for years, answered, based on what I've just said, no, because of the soldier's ability to react. I now answer yes, it does erode the warrior ethic, but in the minds of the public, therein lies the problem. The Canadian government has been misleading the Canadian public for over a decade now, referring to ourselves as a peacekeeping nation. Now, we killed more enemy in the previous century in just causes per capita, I think, than any other country in the world other than Australia, in just causes. World War I, World War II, we declared Korea just, etc. But yet the perception, for political reasons that's been created, is that we're this great peacekeeping nation, Boy Scouts with guns going around the world solving people's problems. And that's got political hay for the government in power, the party in power, but it's untrue, because your credibility as a peacekeeper is probably somewhat proportional to your history of having stood up for just causes. If you're just peacekeepers, then with great respect, for the Swedes who do a lot of it, you do have some credibility problems in some areas if you're just peacekeepers. Credibility particularly with the belligerents with whom you're working too, whether they're professional armies or factions. And so the public then says, well, you mean we're going to go to Afghanistan and kill people? Yes, if they attack the food convoys or if they try and take over a warehouse, we'll be killing them. Gee, does that fit in with our peacekeeping role? Yes, it does, but that's not the way it's been sold. To exaggerate, you know, a lot of Canadians think peacekeeping is helping little old ladies across the street in Bangladesh through the traffic. You know, they think it's that nice touchy-feely stuff, and I'm sorry, that disappeared at the end of the Cold War. The only mission we've had that comfortably fits into the conventional idea of peacekeeping is the recent Eritrea-Ethiopia conflict, where there was an agreement between those two countries to separate, and there's a demilitarized zone in the middle, and we maintained patrols in that area to make sure that there was a pause in the fighting so political solutions, constitutional solutions, could be found. But the rest of peacekeeping, it's an oxymoron. It's not peacekeeping. I mean, it's dangerous stuff. And there's a very, very good chance that you will be drawn into the conflict. Therefore, you have to have not only properly trained troops, but properly equipped troops. And that, I think, that will be a characteristic in the future. There are not enough resources around to go and do the touchy-feely kind of peacekeeping, which is a shame, because the touchy-feeling kind of peacekeeping is a reflection of countries or factions that actually made an effort to get along and want to separate. I mean, at one stage, the UN is actually thinking of sending in 5,000, that's it, 5,000 peacekeepers into the Congo, where there are seven neighboring countries with troops in there fighting over the diamonds and everything else, and 11 factions. So, I mean, And the Secretary General indicated we would only go in there if we had a guarantee of security. Well, who do you get a guarantee of security from in a confusing mess like that, in a place the size of Quebec and Ontario combined? So the intentions are good, but the ability to put the resources together to cope with these problems just isn't there. People are not volunteering their forces for these missions. And those that are, to be terribly unkind, but I think accurate, the lead countries right now, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Nigeria, with great respect, are not industrial strength examples of human rights at home, let alone going around to help somebody else out, and are very much interested in the $1,000 US per soldier per month rental fees for all the equipment, and they're fed and housed while they're away for the year on UN duty or 6 months. Therefore, it's a very attractive deal, particularly to old satellite countries who, in my mission in Sarajevo, a lot of my satellite country militaries were not being paid, nor were their families being paid at home. I mean, they were there because their government was getting hard U.S. currency for their participation. That's not a great motivating factor. That's not a great way to produce soldiers to really help out the local population.
Rwanda, obviously you weren't there, but mm-hmm. Clearly, you have a knowledge of what happened there. What did happen to the small United Nations force, UNAMIR, that was there?
That force that went in there, and I'm not being the least bit disloyal here, Romeo Dallaire is a friend, and we've discussed this, that was a mission sent to a quiet little spot where it looked like things were going to be okay. And so we'll just send in a modest mission. Its presence there will be enough to implement the various accords that had been negotiated. And when it started to turn nasty, and everybody knew it, I mean, you know, there's this famous debate about the Dallaire memo that came back to the UN warning of pending genocide. And the blame now is laid at the feet of the Secretariat for not passing it on to the Security Council. Well, I did a bunch of articles on that because when I had my obligatory and much enjoyed meeting with Her Majesty coming back from Sarajevo, she indicated to me she enjoyed my messages from Sarajevo. Well, I never sent her any messages from Sarajevo, but subsequently discovered that messages that came from commanders in the field in those days, 92 and 93, were normally seen by the representatives of the permanent five of the Security Council before they were seen by the person to whom they were addressed. And sometimes the code, they were decoded before they were handed over. So if anybody tells me that the permanent five didn't know exactly what was going on in Rwanda, in addition to what Dallaire knew, because Dallaire was like me in Sarajevo, his intelligence gathering was zero, and he couldn't really see all that far from his hotel room or his headquarters. But in the case of the permanent five, there was some pretty sophisticated intelligence gathering going on, human in, that told those nations exactly what was going on. So for them to now say, well, we didn't see Dallaire's message, so we didn't know, is crap. I mean, it's just not true. And so there was a conscious decisions made not to get involved. And Somalia, the shadow of Somalia, was a very, very dark shadow hanging over that particular operation. Some people reacted out of self-interest, the French intervening, the Belgians leaving after some of their people were slaughtered. But there was a perfect example of crossing your fingers and praying for the best case scenario for the modest little mission you're sending in. Because a lot of those were unarmed observers who are very effective in some areas where people agree and you seriously... They have great credibility, and you believe they're telling you the truth, that they don't want to fight anymore, but they want somebody in to maintain an international presence and report back to New York. That wasn't the case in Rwanda. There was no desire to. The Arusha Accord, I think it was. There had been some signatures put on a piece of paper, but the situation had changed so dramatically since that time, and as a result, a tiny little mission just got caught. Now, to further condemn the Security Council in hindsight, which is easy, Dallaire's recommendation and Boutros-Ghali, the Secretary General's recommendation, was that Dallaire's force be expanded. You know, and he could do a little bit more maybe then. Not expanded to the extent that he was recommending. Boutros Ghali wouldn't go along with that, but a significant expansion. They ended up cutting it by 2/3 and leaving him there, you know, on the balcony watching the slaughter. I mean, the idea was, UN will do that quite frequently, leave a tiny little force on the ground, and then when the situation improves, you have something on which to expand. You've got your, you've got the mandate in place. You don't have to go back to the Security Council and change everything. And that tiny little force was just caught up in a slaughter. So a perfect example of praying for best scenario.
Other people describe that as a case of the West in particular being prepared to put enormous time and effort into keeping white people alive in former Yugoslavia, but not giving a damn about black people in Africa. Is that a fair chance?
That's pretty tough wording, but certainly what's important is that that's a legitimate perception, and perception has an impact on how we operate within the international community, and certainly our relations within Africa. If you can talk about it as a homogeneous grouping of people, certainly that was the perception. I think Bosnia received a significant amount of attention because it was European. It was the first time it happened. Events like Rwanda had happened all too frequently in the past, and therefore there's a bit of fatigue there about all of that. Whereas, I mean, my God, World War II's been over for 50 years, and here this, we now have an example of this horrible thing happening in the Balkans, and with all the historical context and background and all of that. So that would tend to temper that particular point of view. But the perception worldwide probably was that, yeah, it's an African problem, so it doesn't receive the care and attention that Europe will receive. And I think Somalia, because it was so close to what happened in Rwanda, people are still recoiling from that. Because that was significant humiliation, the decision just to leave. I went there on the day, as a journalist, the day the UN took over from the American-led coalition force. And the commander there at the time, when he discovered that one of the journalists wandering around Mogadishu was General McKenzie, who had just come from commanding a mission, or at least part of a mission, and he called me into his office and said, "Can you tell me what's going on? I cannot believe I've been left here with these inadequate resources. You know, the Americans are leaving, taking all their logistics. They left me a brigade, but I can't employ it. Only my 2IC can employ it, who happens to be an American two-star, who just happened to be a good friend of mine." And he said, "I'm sitting here with no ability to take over this mission that the Americans are leaving." To which my reaction was, "Welcome to the UN. You know, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to do the best you can."
You argue that perhaps Americans shouldn't get involved directly in the peacekeeping, but only to provide logistical support. Yet it seems that certainly politically that nobody will act, you know, the EU, the West generally, without some American commitment. How do you affect peacekeeping under those contradictions?
Well, I guess you have to put up or shut up on one of them, where the Americans don't get involved and the rest will by default. But you're absolutely right, and that, I must admit, hadn't transpired. I had no idea that the rest of the world would be so reluctant to get involved in these crises if America wasn't present. I mean, in Europe, to be paranoid, I can understand it a little bit. I mean, if America wasn't the lead member of NATO, then my guess is that Britain, France, and Germany would be at it again over who's the leader in the European. I don't mean going to war either. I just mean, but there'd be some serious diplomatic battles going on. So it's in their interest to keep the Americans there. But it really surprises me that in many missions around the world, they keep crying out for the world superpower to come and help them police it, and then probably complain about them sticking around too long after it's over, which is one of the problems with peacekeeping. You tend to establish a presence, which is then seen as in their national self-interest. You know, the big camps that the Americans have built in Kosovo, oh my God, this is a geopolitical, you know, aiming at the heart of the old Soviet Union and all this stuff. Maybe it's true, it just doesn't seem that way to me. Americans, wherever they go, build big camps with a lot of comfort for their soldiers. They look after them. But yeah, I've been disappointed that there hasn't been more subcontracting. The only subcontracting from the UN that, and it was successful, was the subcontracting to the Australians for East Timor. which went quite relatively well. Too late, mind you. I mean, a lot of us were saying months before the Australians got involved, this is a disaster. U.S. sent out, once again, a tiny U.N. mission. It's got no ability to defend itself. We are predicting to you, when this election comes along, you are going to have a slaughter, which is exactly what happened. So it's not that people can't foresee these things coming. It's the fact that the institution has a hard time, the UN has a hard time, because it is a collection of 189 nations, or 15 the Security Council, which five represent the world of 1945, but nevertheless have tremendous influence as veto holders on issues of international peace and security. And as a result, there will be missions in the future, I'm sure, where they will send modest forces into very dangerous circumstances. Although, to be fair, Kofi Annan, having spent his entire life, working life there, probably understands that better than most, and you will notice a dramatic reduction in the number of UN missions since Kofi has been Secretary General, because he can go in front of the Security Council and say, I really can't do that for you unless you give me the resources. And the resources come out of the General Assembly. And so there have been fewer missions. And Canada, the great patter on her own back of the leader in this peacekeeping business, has gone from some 5,000 deployed peacekeepers in 1992 with troops from Cambodia to Cyprus to Yugoslavia to Somalia to less than 300 now. I mean, it's embarrassing because the government keeps saying, we're in 13 missions around the world. Well, they're absolutely right, and 10 of them are in single digits. You know, one guy in Sarajevo, two in El Salvador, that type of thing. But yet they say, well, we're in 13 missions. But we have pulled back dramatically from peacekeeping. Now, we have a large contingent in Bosnia, 1,600, wearing NATO insignia. But nevertheless, we're no longer leaders. We're way down the pecking order in UN peacekeeping.
What prescriptions would you apply if you were able to make the United Nations more effective? I mean, are we talking about reforming the Security Council?
Yeah, and I know the wording in the charter says thou shalt not change the makeup of the permanent five unless all permanent five members agree unanimously. So it's going to be very difficult. Then they say, well, maybe we could have second tier, we could have Japan and Germany, to which my reaction is, oh, it's the balance in your bank account then that gets you on the Security Council. I would much rather see a more geographic distribution. For example, Brazil in South America, big supporter of the UN and peacekeeping. But then again, somebody says, oh my God, you can't have the only Portuguese-speaking nation in South America, you know, sort of thing. What'll all the Spanish ones say? India has been a major supporter, long before it was financially attractive of the UN. So there are areas around the world. Africa obviously should have a representative. But am I optimistic it's going to happen? No. No, I think the five nation club are going to hold unto themselves that authority. It's only natural, I guess, because they have it. They will never, in my estimation, ever permit a standing UN army, because that would give the Secretary General his or her own army, and the last thing the Security Council wants is the Secretary General with the ability to launch a force, even with their tacit approval. And so I think we will continue to enhance the current deployment techniques, which are getting better. It used to take about 6 months to get a force on the ground. You can probably do it now in just over a month, because the United Nations has an inventory of what countries will provide in the event that the crisis is in your national self-interest, you know, to get involved. So from that point of view, it's a bit better. But a number of things that have come to the fore that we have been recommending, scores of us for years. First of all, one of the most difficult things to do in a UN force is to establish a headquarters. It normally takes a year to get a headquarters up and running. All the language difficulties and procedures. So now what the UN is doing is identifying national headquarters to go in and take the lead in setting the thing up. That has an immense impact. For example, when I left Sarajevo and the mission expanded all of Bosnia, AFNET, Allied Forces Northern Europe actually sent their headquarters for Morion. A functioning, operating NATO headquarters went in there. So immediately he had a functional headquarters going, and that's a great idea. And there's much more staff horsepower in New York, not enough at headquarters UN now to do the planning for these operations. So they've come a long way. They still don't have an operations center. I get into a tremendous argument with Mary Goulding, the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping, on this, because I was calling for an operational ops center. And what they created, this 24 and 7 they created in 93, is merely a situation room where the media can call in or where commanders can call in, but they have no authority to execute. They send everything to the main building, the main UN building. It's a big step in the right direction, and at least there's always somebody there to answer the phone. Not only that, they have a map and a staff list. They know who you are. They know where you are and all of those basic things. So they've come a long way. There's no doubt about that.
You gave a talk lately on the subject of peacekeeping in the age of terror. Just to take that sentence in two parts. The age of terror. What kind of conflicts do you think are going to feature from now on into a very crowded 21st century? Is it going to be terrorism? Are we going to be seeing wars about environmental consequences of environmental destruction? Are we going to be seeing more genocides?
I think we'll continue to see Ignatieff's theory coming to the fore, and that is factional groups. It can be based on religion, color, history, territory, or whatever, but I think we'll continue to see people striving to improve their lot in life. I keep reminding Canadians that of the 43 wars I think that are going on today, you know, probably in every one of them people are fighting to have maybe one-tenth of what we take for granted in the West by quality of life and peace and security. So I think people will continue. There appears to be, unfortunately, some polarization by religion and fanatical groups on all sides. I mean, I don't blame Islam for Al-Qaeda any more than I blame Christians for the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, you know, sort of thing. It happens. There are radical interpretations and perverse interpretations. That would be a very serious situation, because a lot of the terrorism, most of the terrorism that I'm aware of, is regional, and it's looking for regional change, whether it's Hamas, Hezbollah, or whatever, whereas Al-Qaeda is one of the few transnational terrorist groups, and hopefully we can deal with most of that. So I think it'll be ethnic, factional conflicts. The good news is that the UN no longer sends in just the military. Military is only one, and sometimes not even the majority, part of these missions. We do have a habit of going in to try and clean up the mess after it's over and help put the country back together again, whether it's Cambodia, East Timor, Kosovo, or whatever. So a whole bunch of folks show up from whether it's election supervision, bureaucrats, administrators, legal side, all of that. Coordination of NGOs, they hate it, but in a lot of cases they succumb to it because it offers them some security. And in some cases, even NGOs contribute to the problem. By that I mean, with great intention, they tend to get used by local warlords, whatever, because food is currency and food is power and medicine is power. But the UN is in a much better position these days to coordinate all of that. It was encouraging to see a lot of the Afghans turn to the UN as coming in here and giving us a hand, because it's not seen as a superpower. It was interesting, Pardo, I think I could have the pronunciation wrong, but Ambassador Pico, when he went into Lebanon, and he was blindfolded and driven through a circuitous route through Beirut, taken into a room, unblindfolded. He was meeting with the people who were holding the American, primarily American hostages and UK, and they said to him, the first question they said to him, are you from the Security Council or are you from the Secretary General? And he said, I had this horrible feeling if I gave the wrong answer, I was going to be killed. And he said, I'm from the United Nations. I'm from the Security Council. And everything was copacetic. If he had said the Security Council, it was seen as superpower influence, particularly American domination, and he figured he wouldn't have got out of there. And so that's, in a minuscule way, I think that's represented around the world, too. The UN can, in many instances, have a lot of that sort of neutral credibility, which, much to his credit, Kofi Annan has brought that sort of aura to his office, and it has to be exploited.
Who pays for it?
Well, the Americans keep saying, not us, thank you very much, and pulling back on their percentages, but at least now, under the current administration, they're pumping a lot of those back dues in there. I was one of the persons that that appeared in front of Congress and told them they were quite right in withholding some of their funds, because I outlined some of the wastage that I'd seen, which was really, I thought, quite disappointing to see some of the money, the limited money, the way it was being used, even within peace operations, being wasted on large per diems and civilian staff and the creature comforts. Once again, that wasn't too bad during the Cold War. It was a career. But when it comes time to, gee, we don't have enough money to provide the operational troops we need because we're spending the money on whatever it is, civilian staff flying first class into the operational theater, then it was a problem. But now that's being cut back, but Japan has been a major, major contributor. There's got to be some way to adjust the funding formula on an evolving basis. It tends to get frozen, as I understand it, and some percentages are terribly, terribly small. Some countries, like my own, for a while provided with one-tenth of 1% of the world's population. We were doing 10% of the UN's peacekeeping, but we were also sending them paper payments, and we were deducting, you know, our contribution from our annual payments. So some people do it in kind as opposed to in cash. It's a minuscule amount of money in the overall context of things. I mean, even the UN bureaucracy, everyone screams how big it is. I mean, we have a larger bureaucracy running the city of Winnipeg, you know, one of our small cities. It's not a big bureaucracy. Some of it's, unfortunately, old boy net, you know, sort of a good place to have a career, nevertheless. But as in the overall scheme of things, it's a small number of people and a relatively small budget. I mean, you can pull all kinds of examples, you know, one day's worth of cruise missiles in the war, you know, we'll pay for the UN for 5 years or whatever. But nevertheless, I made that up. I don't know whether that's accurate, but something along that line. It really isn't that much money. I like the idea of international money transfers being, you know, assessed 0.01% or something like that to pay for it.
Just slipping to one side and going back to a fundamental question. The law, as far as the soldier is concerned, about obedience to orders, how does that work in the Canadian Army?
The law
about obeying orders. I'm trying to bring in the notion that a lot of the crimes in the 20th century have been ascribed to soldiers in the field obeying orders. How binding is obedience to orders in the field?
Well, it's an interesting point you bring up, because in spite of the fact that we agree, the public thinks we disagree, and that's General Dallaire and I. We both lecture on the subject, and I'm very firm in my conviction that when the chips are down, and in the final analysis, many people will argue, based on what I argue to be a wartime scenario, that loyalty is up. In other words, when you've exhausted all your abilities to analyze what you've been told to do, if you have a problem with it, your loyalty is up to the country, to the commander-in-chief, in our case, the governor-general, and you go and do it, even if you disagree with it. And General Dallaire buys into that it's government, country, it's then your subordinates, and then yourself. That's who you look after. I've argued that in actual fact, that doesn't always fit in UN operations. That sometimes you will get to a point where your loyalty is downward to your subordinates, to your soldiers. And I say that, making up an analogy based on fact, I guess, that stuck in a bunker in Sarajevo with a flashlight, reading the latest direction from the UN, the latest resolution that's telling you to do something that is totally and absolutely impossible. And you say, who put this together? And then you realize, this is a compromise. This is 15 folks coming to the lowest common denominator. This is what they're asking me to do. And this will result in the death of my soldiers. Sorry, folks, I have a really hard time hearing you. I guess I didn't get this instruction. And there are times, not many, most people think I'm saying this happens all the time. No, but there will be instances where your loyalties will be down. And you'll have a big smile on your face at your court-martial, because you can live with yourself. It's not something that's going to bother you. And quite frankly, it's not something that will be a career stopper. Now, from a legal point of view, the soldier is told that if the order is unethical, then he or she not only can but has an obligation not to follow it. That to me, I can't even think of one incident in my commission career of 33 years where that's happened. But I have had instances where, let me give you an example. One of the UN resolutions that came out shortly after I left Sarajevo was, not only will you deliver the humanitarian aid, but you will use such force as necessary to guarantee the delivery of humanitarian aid. Well, it would have been nice if such force as necessary had been available to the commander on the ground. You can try to get it through with the resources you have available. Even my own soldiers many times said, you know, sir, that checkpoint has been stopping us down by the eastern entrance to Sarajevo. They won't let us get through. We can go through there using force if you want. To which my reaction was, yes, you can, but there's another 200 checkpoints between there and the nearest secure location for you, like the border or split or somewhere like that. So you will get through number one, but before you get to 198, you're going to be dead. So that's irresponsible. That's proven nothing. In fact, your aid will be stolen too. And so there was an example of writing a resolution in the Security Council that just didn't make any sense on the ground. You can't use such force as necessary if necessary force isn't available. And therein lies the dilemma. Now, someone who is a slave to the order, someone who is a slave to the overall authority of who was ever running the operation, in this case the UN, would do that. And the force would be dead. Within 24 hours, there'd be nobody left.
One of the people who was indicted, in fact, the first indictee for genocide was General Krstic, who was the corps commander for the Drina Corps, taking orders from Mladic, I guess, for what happened at Srebrenica. What does a soldier do under that circumstance? What does he do if he gets an order from his superior to... This is something beyond your experience.
Yeah.
Thank God for us all. But what happens, you know, when he gets an order from his superior? Where does he go? You know, you're going to wipe out 5,000-6,000 Muslim men. How does a soldier take to this? I mean, what are the responses? What is his way of actually saying no to this?
Well, the legitimate response, I mean, the proper response, is not to carry out the order. How you do it in those conditions can get pretty nasty. I mean, I've been asked many times questions about ethical decision making, and the questioner always makes it complicated, and it's not. In my estimation, when you're faced with an ethical dilemma, ethical decision, moral decision, all you have to do is imagine someone you really love looking over your shoulder. It can be your daughter, your son, your wife, your best friend, or whatever. It makes it really easy because you immediately know what you're supposed to do. Sometimes it's hard for you to make up your mind because there are implications for you personally, and whether we like it or not, no matter how brave we like to act, I mean, your personal security comes into it. And so the right decision in those cases, when you're being told to separate the men from the women and, you know, and kill as many as you possibly can over the next 48 hours or whatever was said, is not to do it and say, I cannot follow that order. I mean, you'll probably be marched off to jail or whatever, but you say, I can't follow that order. Yeah, somebody will probably show up along the chain of command and will go ahead and do it, but nevertheless, that's your obligation in any army. Not applies to the Serbs as well as to the Brits, the Canadians, or whatever. Now, unfortunately, there's a momentum to these things, you know, and there's an atmosphere that's created where that sure in hell didn't happen very much in the Balkans by the sound of it.
Cut. Thank you very much, General.